Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, John Holland. John is the head coach at Mentally Agile Leaders, where he and his team focus on growing, developing, and supporting emerging leaders across the private and nonprofit sectors. John is also a retired United States Army intelligence colonel with command and staff positions, including platoon leader, company and battalion commander, chief of staff, and inspector general. His assignments include, but are not limited to, the 1st Special Forces Command, the 82nd Airborne, and the United States Army Operations Crisis Action Team during the 9/11 attacks. John has a wealth of experience that has helped him develop tremendous insight and approaches for leadership development, problem solving, and communication. And I'm really excited to share all of those with all of you today. Now, before we do, considering John's background, there's an important message that we need to share as well before we get started. Mr. Holland's views, information, and opinions expressed do not reflect the official policy, position, or view of the United States government, including the Department of Defense. He is here in his personal capacity. His statements only reflect his personal ruminations, lessons learned, thoughts, and expressions. With that out of the way, let's quickly thank our sponsors and jump right into our conversation. First, as always, we have HumanTel. Please, when you have the moment, head over to humantel.com. That's where you can check out all of their self-paced online best-in-class training to learn what people are likely thinking and feeling at any moment by evaluating their change of emotions via their changing facial expressions and body language. While you're there, enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off of their best-in-class training. I've done it myself. I vouch for it. Please head over to humantel.com and enter the code INCLUSIVE25. For the professional interviewers, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about the International Association of Interviewers, what membership potentially offers for you and your organization, networking opportunities, educational opportunities, both in person and online, interviewer resources, and so much more. That is also where you can learn about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation, what it takes to qualify for and earn the designation and maintain it as well. All you need to know over at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to teach for their senior leadership team, sales teams, and HR teams when they are looking for strategic observation and persuasive communication techniques to help their leaders obtain everyday confessions throughout their business conversations. All that in much more detail and more at inquasive.com. I thank you all for continuing to join us for these conversations. Thank you for being here today. And now I'm excited to introduce to you, John Holland. Good afternoon, John. It is great to see you. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here today. How are you?
Great, Michael. Thank you. Just really excited about talking to you today and supporting your efforts. Just super glad to be here.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you very much. And your background is so diverse. You've done so many things. I'm sure that we could spend time just dissecting public speaking, triathlons. I can't wrap my head around what it would take to do a triathlon. I run a couple of miles, and that's more than enough for me when I actually have the discipline to do that. Obviously, your military background, the leadership coaching that you do now. So to try to find a theme to wrap this all around and really go down that leadership route, when we were speaking earlier, you mentioned to me that you were at the Pentagon on 9/11. And I want to be very careful and respectful approaching that topic and asking about it. Certainly, I remember that day, but I wasn't involved in other than being just a spectator to those unfortunate events. But I would like to ask you, as you were there at the Pentagon that day and in the role that you served at the time, without going into detail, I have no doubt that you were involved in many conversations about what was happening, what to do, where to go, short and long term. So putting all of the politics aside, the question that I would really love to ask you to get started is, what did you learn about responding to a crisis that day that you still employ with the leaders you coach and develop today?
I think the first lesson is that you will fight, or you will respond to an emergency the way you trained. You can't those behaviors or actions, they, if you don't train or rehearse them, you have nothing to default to. And that training is super important because your mind will just simply go right to them. And this is particularly when the personnel that were out treating the wounded, the casualties, the medics, just even though, I'll give you a better example. My boss at the time was a full colonel, but his prior enlisted rank was like a specialist, you know, a private, and he was a medic. And even though that had been decades earlier, he immediately responded to that training and started treating people with whatever he could find for the burns and the injuries, napkins, water bottles, whatever we could find to help those people. So training, you know, it's a come as you are event, and that training is super critical before something happens. The other thing I learned is that I was actually, you know, just to be clear, I was across the street from the Pentagon. We actually moved out of the offices that actually got hit some months earlier. So we're very fortunate in that regard. But leaders ride to the sound of the guns, which is a Civil War quote, meaning that leaders are where the action is. They don't lead from the rear, they lead from the front. So I was really impressed with the number of senior leaders, military and civilian, that actually were running toward where, you know, the events were happening to take charge and start treating people, removing casualties and assessing what had happened. Yeah. It's in retrospect, a very traumatic day, huge loss for the nation. But the other thing I learned is that the emotional quality of groups is that everyone realized this was an event that would change the direction of the nation, of the American people. That was a fact that was coming out. And people, you could feel, were emotionally gearing up. The nation was going to war against somebody. And you could, you know, just waiting for the president to give us the go ahead. But we were already mentally preparing to go that direction.
I appreciate you sharing that with us. Thank you. One of the things that fascinates me personally, and I've asked several people their perspective from varying backgrounds, is how they develop the ability to stay calm in events like this. I mean, obviously, for everybody, it's not an event this significant or this tragic, but it could be you're surprised at work, you got a customer yelling at you, something happens on the freeway in front of you, any of these like moments of crisis, to bring it back to a more everyday type example. Training, I'm sure, has a lot to do with it. Maybe some people are just more wired to be calm. But as you think about many of the experiences that you went through throughout your military career, how did you learn to stay calm in situations where most people would likely freeze or panic?
I'll answer your question, but I want to say this is, I spent a lot of my time from being a young lieutenant all the way up to colonel in the presence of some of the nation's, you know, greatest leaders. And what I realized is one of the hallmark talents that separates the general officers and the senior executive service members and the really effective CEOs is making decisions under pressure. Just that ability alone distinguishes the great from the average. And if you look at any of the Leadership Circle 360 assessments in the book by Anderson and Adams, it really points to that ability. And they just have a lot of them just trained and just practice to drop into another gear and really focus on, okay, one, what is the mission here? Two, what steps or actions fulfill that mission, and what can be ignored? And a lot of that decision-making is a bit intuitive, and it only gets to be intuitive through a lot of repetition and practice and deliberately looking for difficult and hard situations. In the past, they've just deliberately taken on hard training, hard jobs where they could actually test fire their responses under stress. And what I noticed in my own case is when things are really going badly, that you just take a moment, kind of mentally kind of separate yourself from the situation, kind of detach and assess. Just take a breather, breathe a few times, let your logic part of your brain catch up to your primitive part of your brain, because that primitive part of your brain, which is running on adrenaline and emotions, very fast, and it tends to make bad decisions typically. Let your rational mind catch up. You do that deep breathing exercise, is mentally detached and take a step back and take a look at this. And I'll just give you a brief situation. We found ourselves stuck in sand in the first Gulf War in Humvees. We weren't really used to being out in deep desert in these things. And we had, it got stuck. And long story short, the communications weren't working. These were FM radios, not a long distance. So we actually, okay, what do we do? Think about it. Nobody panic. We actually tied a Kim light to antennas, duct taped them together and stood on the Humvee, sort of waving it around. And we finally had someone call us and said, hey, is that you guys? Yeah, shoot me a compass azimuth. This was before GPS. So you had to be able to use a compass. Didn't panic, but found a simple way to solve that problem and get back to where we needed to be. So
life is a series of solvable problems. Just gotta figure out how to take the time to focus on them, or focus on the solutions, I should say.
Right. Exactly.
That decision under pressure, I'm going to blank. I believe it was Ben Sands, somebody that I spoke with recently, mentioned the same thing. He's been on the corporate side for his whole career, so it comes at it from a different perspective, but essentially had the same thread through his conversation, that really what distinguishes great leaders is their ability to make decisions under pressure in ambiguous circumstances. So, excuse me, I know you mentioned the training, people intentionally putting themselves in hard positions to make hard decisions. I'm sure that for most people in that scenario, and I can't speak to the military side, obviously, but to some degree, embracing the opportunity to fail, like this might not work. So early in my career, as I'm making these decisions where it's a little bit safer to fail, taking that opportunity, taking that risk to learn, outside of putting themselves in position to make difficult decisions, did you notice any other structures or processes that these great leaders you were around operated under in order to help guide them to quick and correct decisions more often than not under these stressful circumstances?
I think there is, one, that the military, particularly the Army and the Marine Corps, are really good at taking young leaders, putting them in deliberately difficult situations, some that there is not going to be a good answer, and letting them fail. The motto is that you come in here humble, or the training is going to humble you, your choice, and let them fail, get used to that failure, and living wearing ambiguity like a fine tailored suit, and allowing them that freedom to fail. I don't see that a lot in some civilian organizations where the senior leaders have a tolerance for failure if they can learn from it. They should really communicate that downward into their culture and go, guys, hey, I know that new guy, he really made a mess of that project or botched that sale. Get him in here, get his confidence back up, do an AAR, learn from it, and keep going. I don't see that a lot in the civilian. The military does a really good job at having a lot of tolerance for failure, you know, at that level. To answer your question, I think leaders that I have seen they're great human beings to start with, and that's because they spend a lot of time making themselves adhere to a core set of values that is who they are. That if you were asked me what my values are, I can tell you, courage, trust, humility, authenticity, integrity, love, honesty, optimism, obedience, and discipline are my core values. And I bet you could ask probably any general officer in the Army or senior officer, probably even any sergeant major, and they could tell you what those values are. And when they're making decisions, they ask intuitively almost, am I honoring these values in this decision? Does this decision solve the problem? And they're really good at weighing multiple courses of action in their head, weighing the pros and cons, and making that decision. And one other point to here, Michael, the best leaders I have seen verbally do that in front of their staffs. So if there's a decision to make, do we embrace this new product line? Do we embrace this new weapon system? Whatever it is, they'll say, guys, I'm just thinking out loud. If we do this, here's what's good and the bad, and here's where I see it going. If we do that, good and bad, I see where that's going. They put this out there so their staff can see how they think, because if the general is not around, or the colonel's not, or the captain's not around, the staff needs to know what his intent is so they can fulfill that role. The second thing I've seen really great leaders do in decision-making, particularly when it's a very stressful situation, they will say, this is what they won't say. They won't say, here's what I think we should do. What do you think? Because the staff is just going to go, okay, sir, that's a great idea, right? They'll say, first off, what do you guys think? So they get that honest, open feedback on the table rather than implant a bias right off the bat.
That's a great point, because you're right. People who are, whether they're just obedient, whether they're worried about disrespecting somebody, whether they, well, you're the leader, you're supposed to have the good idea. So if that's your idea, then it's my idea.
Exactly.
Then you're automatically influencing how they think before you give them a chance to answer.
Yep.
You did cut to the chase for one of the things that I did think I would ask you at some point, which were, what are your core values of leadership? Because I know that's a big part of what you do now with your clients. So we'll circle back to that. I think I was able to write about half of them down as you were going through. So we'll circle back to those. But I did want to come back to the point you made about leaders, especially in the private sector, not embracing failure enough. I see that consistently. We're wired to learn more from our failures than our successes. And the vast majority of opportunities we have to fail are not metaphorically fatal to the organization. We can fix it. We can make up for it. Most of the time, it's not going to bring us all down. It's a great opportunity to help separate the process from the results, teach someone how to solve this problem in a way that helps them solve similar problems, build morale, build confidence, all those things that you said. And time again, leaders get so frustrated because if you fail, it wastes my time when I have to get involved and fix it. Now I'm offended because I have to get involved in something that I pay you to do. And that moral affront just shuts down the opportunity for them to learn and develop people. Encouraging people to fail, putting them in a position to fail, holding their belt while they do it so you can pull them right back and you can help them through it. Talk about trust, morale, employee engagement, path of future development, all of those things. Just by encouraging people to make mistakes and helping them through the process, we can solve so many of those problems. I love how you brought that up. And I think for me to hear it, it's a little bit counterintuitive to think that the Army supports failure more than business leaders do. Because on the surface, you think about what failure could mean in the Army in the worst case scenarios compared to worst case scenario, what it could mean in business. I mean, those aren't equal. But if we embrace failure early when the consequences aren't that big, then we have people making better decisions more consistently when the consequences are that big.
Yeah, the military is really good at autopsying failures. Okay, what went wrong? Was it a leadership failure? Okay, drill down. Who said what? What did the order say? Why did we do that? Did this work? Did it not work? And sometimes the trap is sometimes have just enough success it doesn't warrant review, but we always drill down after every training exercise, every event, everything. Okay, what worked? Did the equipment work? Did the people work? Was the logistics working behind it? Was the mission a success? Yes or no? In fact, I actually had read something. I'm not sure where it was, but when the rocket company X, rocket company to shoot the rockets in the air?
Oh, Elon Musk company.
Elon Musk company.
Now, yeah, I know I'm drawing a blank too. Yeah.
SpaceX. Thank you.
I
read somewhere those guys actually would cheer when a rocket didn't launch or failed because it gave them a chance to get better. And if you hit on a point, the morale of a company, if you have an employee, a salesman, a quality control man or something like that, he makes a mistake. If you bring him in and say, hey, let's just see what happened and make this better and fix it and make you better, that think about from that employee's perspective, the loyalty he has for the company now, for, you know, hey, they didn't throw me out. I feel better. I feel more comfortable. I'm not risk averse because I know if I make a mistake, they're going to help me fix it, make it better. And if I see an opportunity and I make a judgment call and it pans out and the company makes an increased profit or saves money, it's so much the better, right? But if you leave him unconfident, shell-shocked and risk averse, that does not work.
He's going to be paralyzed from a decision-making perspective, which will only frustrate us more because I pay you to make decisions and now you're not making them. Well, I'm not making them because every time I do, you hit me with a shock collar.
That's exactly right.
So why would I put myself in that position again?
Yeah, but you actually have to have that after-action reviews as built in. They have to be deliberate.
Yeah.
You know, a Thursday, 4 o'clock, you can call it something, you know, Black Shirt Friday. Every Friday, we're going to wear black shirts. We're going to meet at lunch. We're going to circle around and we're going to lay this thing out, you know, non-attribution. What is going right? What is going wrong? and then own the problems and get them fixed and celebrate the things that go right.
Yes.
As vigorously as you do the things that need fixing.
And the things that need fixing, and you mentioned this earlier, did the equipment work? It doesn't have to be, are you going to meet the deadline? Where are you in relation to the deadline? Now, I'm under the swinging spotlight. I have all the pressure. I want to protect myself. If the question is, based on all the curveballs the customer has thrown us, what obstacles do we currently need to clear to make the deadline? Now it's about the obstacles. Now I can talk about it. My self-esteem, yes. My self-image is safe. So we can talk through the difficult piece. And then when it comes to celebrating the success, celebrate the people, build them up. So that way they're more open during these conversations. For people who are leaders, who are bold enough to take that jump and commit the time, I mean, you know much better than me from your experience, the results just catapults.
Yeah. In fact, when I was at Fort Irwin, California, I was with the Light Infantry Task Force. And after every parachute jump where we would train a ranger, a ranger company or a unit from the 82nd, is if something went really wrong, that at the after action review, they actually had this little mannequin doll that was all beat up. I think it was a Barbie doll. Someone made a uniform for it, had a parachute on it, and they called it the Walking Unconscious Award, meaning that you had to be unconscious to make that decision. And you got to keep that on your desk as a reminder not to do that again. But it was really kind of funny. But what it is, it formalized and recognized that mistake and that everybody on the team, you know, owned it, and we would fix it and make it better and it wouldn't happen again.
Yeah.
It wasn't just random. We actually purposely did these things.
And I don't want it to slip by either when you talked about having the after action reports, even when you're successful. Thankfully, really early on in my investigations career, I was taught you can be successful by accident. Like you can think you did. And in my case, it was a pretty poor interrogation that I did where I still got the confession at the end. And so I walk out, this young interrogator, thinking I did a great job. And my boss takes me out to lunch and sits down and says, you have any idea how lucky you are? Like, what do you mean lucky? I just did this great job. I've been doing this for months and I'm already getting that kind of confession? No. And he starts walking me through and I'm like, oh. So even in the successes, separating the process from the results, and really, would that same process lead me to future success? Almost certainly not. So if I'm just making the decision based on the results, that process will fail me again at some place. So having the action after action report on both sides is really important.
Yeah. And again, formalizing that and making it available for future employees to look at, not just leaving it verbally out there, yeah. You know, keep a binder, pass that thing around and read and learn and study where, you know, teams or sales went wrong in the past so you don't repeat those mistakes. It's just invaluable. Should be one of the most, you know, sacred items in a business is that binder. If you've got a past after action review, should be read, studied, and carried around.
Yeah. I jokingly say, don't repeat my mistakes, go make your own. here's what we've already learned the hard way. It's an incomplete list. You can add to it. But please try not to repeat anything that's already on the list.
That's exactly right. A smart man learns from his mistakes, but a really smart person learns from others' mistakes.
Love
They're free.
It. Yes, they are free. Yeah, the pain was somebody else's to bear. You get to watch that one from the outside. To tie this back into the values that you mentioned, and I think you might have mentioned 10 or 12 as you were going through your list, which I have no doubt are deeply tied into what you do, especially now on the private sector side where you are coaching and building leaders within the business community. If you were to narrow that, and every person in every environment is different, I understand, but if you were to narrow your list down to maybe 2, 3, 4, whatever that number is, of really core values that serve as the cornerstones for leadership, would there be several out of that list that you would say, if you're an up-and-coming leader, make these yours first?
Values are really unique to the individual. They're really kind of the essence of who you are. And in fact, when I'm coaching, particularly, I spend a lot of time working, coaching recent college grads who just entered the corporate workforce somewhere, the middle managers looking to move up into the senior leadership positions, is that we'll ask a lot of questions and figure out what their values that are unique to them are. And that when as they make decisions and move through life, are you honoring these things or are you trampling on them? And if they're looking at, they've made decisions and they'll say, I made that decision. It just does not feel right. Well, what values, you know, have you trampled here? But to answer your question, I think the value of discipline and honesty and integrity and authenticity are probably, and the supreme value above all else is courage. This is a Maya Angelou quote in that without courage, the other values will never be employed, will not happen. For example, if you're faced with an unethical situation, if you don't have the courage to stand up and go, not doing that, I'm not participating in that because it is unethical. It's not fair to the customer. It's cheating or whatever the situation is. But courage makes the other ones possible. So those are the values that I would, if I'm a, let's just stick with the example of a freshly minted college student working in an environment. You need to build your reputation as an honest, disciplined, hardworking employee with integrity who has the courage to do the right things. And if that is not working for you in your current company, you're probably in the wrong company. So build that reputation, particularly if you're going to stay in a certain industry, that will propel you forward as a go-to person or to hire and to promote.
That's such sage advice, really, for people at any stage in their career, but I think especially in that middle management piece, because you're stuck in the middle, like you're besieged from all sides. We're trying to lead people that were likely just our peers, or we might have been brought in above without having worked with them previously. We're trying to get to the people above us, and we often feel like they're judging us for any number of things along the way. But if we can focus based on how we communicate, the example we set, how we get our job done, if we can build our reputation around our values, so no matter what happens, people see those things in us, then they're more likely to follow us. They're more likely to understand when we make mistakes. They're more likely to promote us. And that's tremendous advice.
Yeah. One of my first sergeants, who ended up being Sergeant Major, John Meyer, he often would tell me, you know, hey, Lieutenant, the people will follow the uniform, the rank to a point, and afterwards they follow the person. And so if you don't exhibit those values daily to your subordinates and your peers, and again, upwards too, you've got to lead upwards. I call it managing your dragon. If you've got a senior executive that you work for, huge dragon, you've got to manage exhibiting those things. And you kind of hit on something a second ago, is when we hire people, and you're essentially promoting them, and particularly a leadership position, is that you've often heard the Peter principle. You get promoted one position above what you're capable of doing. I don't agree with that. I think you get promoted to one position beyond but what people let you develop into and train you for. So if you hire somebody new or you just got promoted, is again, give them that time to develop, give them the freedom to make mistakes, and help them and encourage them, provide the training in that role, and then have that hard conversation with that new employee or that new middle manager, is that let's talk about values. Let's put them on the table. What are your values? How can we take advantage of your values to excel in this?
For sure. And when I work with leaders, and I'm sure you've seen this any number of times, especially when they're hiring and hiring for management roles in particular, they talk about potential. We want potential. We want values. We want potential. We want someone who can learn and grow and develop. And they say all of the things that if you did a Google search for what you're supposed to say, it would come up. It's like this famous speech. They tell you the same thing every time. But what they really want is a turnkey solution. They want somebody that they can put in the role. They can hand the guidebook or the computer codes or whatever. And now I don't have to worry about this position anymore. I can go do my job. Well, those two things don't come in the same. So we're probably never going to hire the turnkey person. And to your point, if we are hiring the turnkey person, we're probably not getting the most out of them anyway, if that's really what we see them as. So committing to that development path and helping not only get the most out of them, but adding to their potential and aiding their development along the way is, again, so, so important.
Yeah, people are messy. There's just no way around it. And putting that new leader in there and not having these discussions about values expectations, culture, et cetera. And one thing that I've started doing and have been harping on for a while is that a lot of job descriptions are you're looking for skills and potential. What you really need, though, is capacity that can be grown, and you need attributes. You should be interviewing for attributes, and that's different than skills. Skills can be taught. I can teach you how to run the system, produce that. But attributes like aggressiveness, growth mindset, deliberate thinking, these are just humor. They have humility. These are attributes they have, and that's what your interview process, I think, should ferret out. We spend a lot of time developing interview questions that get after attributes of this person. They have the right attributes.
Thank you. Just yesterday, one of the executives in the group I was working with was talking about working with different problem employees, and he says, we only hire people with a growth mindset. And in the back of my mind, I'm going, I bet you do. And as he's talking through the interview process, like, we tell them that we only bring on people with a growth mindset, and we expect people to have a growth mindset, which means we give direct feedback and they need to be open to direct feedback. And while I love the vacuum that this conversation is having, to your point, what have you done to verify this except tell them that that's only who you hire? So when you hire them, that's how you expect them to be. Like, it's two different conversations happening in the same room at the same time there. So developing those questions and knowing how to identify those attributes is so critical.
Yeah, I think one of the most effective things I have seen done is where a director, he got his current team together and said, okay, we have three positions we have to fill. We all pretty much have the same task, but they're just directed at different customers. Let's write down, if we were to take a hammer and chisel, what it takes to make the ideal candidate, the ideal person, what do they have to have to do this job? Let's build them on paper from the ground up. What does it take to be here? What do you need? What do you have? And they wrestled with it, even though they sucked up the vacuum of not having three staff officers. Let's just take the time to hammer out what we really need. Then when they got it down, they had the values the person had to have, the attributes they had to have. Then they started designing questions that they could transition straight over. They would ask a question like, tell me about the biggest mess you ever made and what you did with it. And they had candidates would say, oh, I've never made a mess. Not hired. Yep. I made a mess, but it was Bob's fault. Not hired. I made the biggest mess. It was a disaster. I made terrible decisions. I did this, I did that. And I stopped and really thought about it. And I let those bake in and marinate. I've never made them again. And I got better. You're our kind of lady. We're taking a year. Right. But it took that deliberative mindset of what do we really need in that position to be successful? And they went hired for it.
Amen. And even coming up with that, that ideal candidate picture, if you will, stops people from one of the core mistakes that people make in hiring, which is comparing two variables. I've got who I believe are the best two candidates out of this candidate pool that I ended up with. So because I think they're the two best, I'm going to compare them to each other and decide which one I think is best for my company. Well, you're comparing two variables without a constant. So just because neither one of them might be right, I might be asking myself which one is less wrong for this position instead of which one is most right. So even by going through that exercise, now you're giving yourself the constant to compare your candidates back to. There's layers and layers and layers of why that's such a great decision. Absolutely the best way to handle it.
And two things, too, is that the best leaders that I have observed, they actually set conditions where values can be demonstrated. Rather than just put them on a board on the wall, hey, here's our values, read them, have a nice day, they will set conditions where values can be demonstrated. When a product comes around, if their value of the team is excellence and that thing is not meeting, hey, guys, this does not meet our value. It's got to go back, whatever. And just to illustrate the point about the attributes, back when I was younger and a lot faster, that I was a high school soccer coach, and I was refereeing big 4A high school games. And at times when they were really good players, you know, they would have college scouts in the stands. they would actually come to us after the game and say, hey, I saw you talking to number three. What was that conversation? And I would say, well, he had another player, for example, that was misbehaving. And I just told him, hey, if you're going to wear that captain armband, get your other player under control before I have to. And he say, what did he say? What the coach was looking for is, what was this kid like behind the foot skills and the speeds? And one of them said to me, the reason I'm asking you is that I give that kid a four-year scholarship and he's a screw up. I have to sit beside him for 4 years. I don't want to do that.
It's a great perspective. And if you carry that over into business, who are the people that have those opportunities to make those connections with your staff? So a scout asking the referee, that's the perfect person to ask. You're in the middle. You are hearing everything on that field. And as somebody who knows the game, you're also, you have a level of situational familiarity where you're picking up on nuances that other people might not. So you have the greater context to report back within. There could be mid-level leaders. There could be influential frontline workers that have access to some of this information and perspective and experience that, as leaders, if we're not finding a way to mine, there's a huge hole in our intelligence gathering when it comes to promotion decisions, employment decisions, even who do we assign what roles or tasks to within their current jobs.
Yeah, I had a battalion commander that, brigade commander, even though he had thousands of people, you know, under, it was a very large brigade. He had, you know, the mess hall staff. He had the mechanics. He would go down to the junior level and climb under trucks in the motor pool to see if it's leaking oil. He would be in the mess hall eating portions of the meal every day to see the quality of the food. He would go to the civilian administrative people and see how things are going. He'd actually be in the barracks seeing if all the washer and dryers were working. And he would engage with that lower level staff just to see how conditions were. How are they being treated by the mid-level managers, the mid-level leaders? Because, you know, his point was, if these things aren't working, the unit will fail in its mission. And I'm not going to promote leaders who are abusive or dismissive of the very people that keep the troops fed, housed, and medically serviced.
Absolutely. I didn't serve in the military, so I want to be careful just agreeing with those. I had an example recently with somebody I was working with where the joke was, don't piss off the people who make your food, right? Don't anger the guy who's going to fix your car. Like these are people that, depending on your status or your schedule or how busy you are or your title or your salary or any one of these things, you might for some reason think you're above, which I couldn't agree more with more vociferously. But now if you treat those people like that, to your point, those are the ones that make your life easy.
Right. Yeah. I'd heard the story of, and I'll use Duke Energy as an example, because I have family and was to work there, but they had a vice president that would go down to their large warehouses in Toddville, North Carolina, on Saturdays and walk around through the warehouse. He would climb under the vehicles that were stored there that would go out for hurricanes and deployments. He'd spend hours down there going through these things. One, he was humble. I need to do these things. I cannot leave these to chance. Second, it gives me a good indication of how professional my staff way below me is doing. So he's honoring his values. He was getting down there where he needed to be to check on things and seeing how the staff, his middle managers, were treating these guys down below. If he put out communications, were they actually being accurately transmitted down multiple levels below?
Without that telephone game taking over as the message gets passed down.
Yes.
So over these last several examples, we're talking about leaders who are involved in the understanding of those around them, the symbiotic impact that they have on each other in their relationship as they work together. Earlier, you mentioned managing your dragon, which would be a leader who doesn't fall into that description. I love the description, managing your dragon. I love how you said it. As you're working with these new leaders that are coming fresh out of college or earlier in their careers, what are some of the most effective techniques or approaches that you work with them to help them learn how to manage their dragons?
So the three things that we that in coaching the these guys is, one is, what is the mission of the organization? What is the mission of your department to fulfill that? And what is your mission to fill the department? And I can't tell you how many college newly entering the workforce, they can't tell me what the mission is. And I said, well, okay, how are you making decisions or helping inform decisions if you don't know what the mission is? Because they should be directed at fulfillment of that mission and why that is. And the second, and there's always this head scratcher. I never thought about that. But if you're new to the workforce, is understanding that mission. By the way, if you're in charge, communicating that mission downward and make sure everyone understands it, that's your job. The second thing is, let's take a minute and imagine ourselves in your boss's seat, in your dragon's chair. This, just mentally go there. What does it look like? It looks like 200 unanswered emails. It looks like the fifth meeting of the day. It looks like six problems that need someone assigned to them. Okay, where can you insert yourself and take something off his plate? Where can you make yourself useful to him? Look at life through his eyes, right? Super important. And the other thing is, how does your dragon best receive communication? Is it a sticky slid under the door? Is it a brief conversation in the hallway? Is it an email? Maybe not, if he's 200 emails behind. How does he best receive and respond to information? The other thing too is, go ahead and help him write his victory speech. If he was to go home content and happy on Friday and he had to make a speech about it, how can you help him write that? What things can you help get out of his way? Again, that goes back to building your reputation, your brand, if you will, within the organization or the field that you're in.
I love all of it. I love all of it. And that thought of, how, and I'm summarizing clearly, how do you make yourself useful to your dragon? Most of the times when people think about their dragon, it's, how do they make me feel? They make me feel compromised. They make me feel embarrassed. They make me feel unvalued, not trusted, all of these negative things. You want me to make their life easier when they make me feel this way? Yeah, assuming it's within professional boundaries, I do. You know, if they're yelling and swearing at you, if they're putting their hands on you, if there's sexual harassment involved, then no, obviously I don't. But in the average dealing with your dragon type scenario that we're talking about, yes, if we can find a way to increase the perception of the value that we add to them, they will breathe less fire towards us. So talking about that discipline and that personal accountability to look for the solution instead of focusing on the problem, I love that approach. Absolutely love it.
Yeah. And if you're, a young emerging leader and you're in these staff meetings, take advantage of these meetings to see how your boss responds to criticism, how he responds to stress, how he makes decisions. Learn the good and the bad from those leaders in those meetings and take notes. How does he get his information? How does he like his information? What makes him happy? What makes him unhappy? These type of things, and how to take advantage of those and learn from those encounters when you get them.
Yeah, establish patterns.
All right.
Times a day, methods of communication. Who's the best person to deliver the message? I've worked for organizations where one person seemed to always get a better reaction than the rest of us. Fair or unfair, who cares? Let's let her deliver the message, or she's the one that's probably going to get the best reaction. Let her be the one.
And let's say you have a leader and she goes what we call high and right. She's just going off in this meeting. Here's your chance to take a few breaths and practice and train to keep your calm and just go, hey, man, I heard everything you said. So we can make that happen. Yeah, we got it too easy. We can make that happen. Practice your own ability to stay calm. Take advantage of that, even though she's breathing fire.
Especially when she's breathing fire, which I think actually is a great setup for something that I saw before our conversation when I was getting ready. And it was just a little line in how you work with people that I found fascinating and super important. You intentionally work with people on their inner voice.
Yes.
I feel like that ties into staying calm. That ties into how we react. That ties into the direction that we take, what we say, all of these things. What have you seen to be the power of our inner voice, and how do you work with these emerging leaders to develop it?
So, huge question. How much time do you have?
As much as we need.
there's there's volumes written in this. And what I've come to learn is that your brain, our brains are pattern recognition machines. They look for patterns. They look for efficiencies and effectiveness because they're primarily built as a survival tool. So they don't like a lot of having to rethink things over and over. It wants to like come to the answer and let's get back to gathering food or looking for threats kind of thing. So this is why, for example, if you're going to the shelf to look for a book you've read often, you're not going title by title by title. You're looking for the red book with the gold label, right? Because your brain just, it's a pattern, right? A plus B equals C, that book 20 times before, I don't have to think about it. So what happens is over time, things happen to you as a youngster, as in your adolescence. This is influenced by coaches, teachers, parents, grandparents that formulate as kind of a survival mode, a survival voice, and it carries into adulthood. And for example, I had a client who's very, very successful, an unbelievable attorney, but all her childhood was, the only accolade she ever got was through successful academics. That was it. So in order to keep doing that, she just kept going to school till finally she went through law school. And really what she wanted to be was just a third grade teacher. And so life was not very fulfilling and very unhappy because she was very stressed all the time as an attorney. She really just was not built to do that. But that inner voice was constantly negatively reinforcing to her that you are a failure. You have to keep being successful, take more classes, get more grades, because it's protecting her ego from being assaulted. And you also see this in people that go to college that they can't risk getting a C taking their hard course in economics. So they'll major in like underwater basket weaving or something, right? Because that got to get that A to protect that ego, because that inner critic is constantly saying, you're a screw up, you're not worthy, you can't do it. Gosh, it's everything a coach or a teacher or a parent ever said to them. And it just horsewhips people terribly. They get forced into jobs, training, positions, relationships they just wouldn't wander into. So we spend a lot of time, okay, why do you have this negative voice? Let's name that voice. Let's give her a name, Betty. Okay, let's examine Betty. Let's write a breakup letter with Betty. Hey, Betty, we've been together since second grade. You really have pushed me this far, but I can't go any further this way. Then what we'll do is we'll work to create a counterbalance to Betty, an inner guide, an inner sage that says, hey, you have a pile of empirical evidence of how great you are in successes, in your degrees, in your job performance, et cetera, et cetera. Let's balance these things out. Let's master these monkeys. Let's be the zookeepers of these monkeys. And this gets at the point of this, particularly if you're an emerging leader, or you're going to be a leader, you have to be the master of your mind, master those emotions, master those voices. So they're serving you rather than you serving them with the latest whim, the latest emotion, you veering you off course, the latest whim or whatever else. Here's the reason why. You're going to whipshaw your staff and your employees everywhere if you're not providing a predictable, stable, consistent culture in your organization. And it all starts with you. And it's controlling that inner voice, that inner guide, et cetera, that you're the master of those things. Cannot just let them run wild.
Of all of that. And thank you for a 5-minute summary of what could have easily been a 55-minute conversation in and of itself. But I don't necessarily think that a lot of people really understand how powerful their inner word choice is and how it makes them feel and how it makes them act. And people live up or down to how they see themselves. And I know you work with people on their identity as well, their personal identity, and it just ties into the inner voice. It's driven by the inner voice. But honestly, even with my son, it's one of the things that I'm constantly trying. He's very young, but one of the things that I'm trying to constantly work on is how do we consistently work to improve our self-identity and inner voice. So it leads us to making better decisions and working through moments of stress and conflict and disappointment more productively. Because if we see ourselves as somebody who is a fighter, a hard worker, who will earn their way through, we'll do it. If we see ourselves as someone who just got lucky, we won't. So mastering your mind. I love that. Mastering your inner voice is so critical.
Yeah, I actually had a client, and this is true, is that through a childhood that was not very pleasant, to put it the least, when he did the slightest thing wrong, his inner voice would say to him, and this is a quote, "You should have been left on the side of a mountain in the rain at birth." That's what he said to himself. Now, you think about the impact that has when you try to move into relationships, into job performance, to getting more training, education, improve yourself. Every little setback is now put in that light versus that's a minor thing, fix it, move on, get better, grow, keep pushing forward, keep hustling, keep getting after it. And I mean, you see how crippling that is. So we spend a lot of time drilling down onto stopping that, balancing it with a better voice. And he's doing fantastic now. He really has. It just, yeah, really.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we say it doesn't have to be that significant, but if we have a negative reinforcement feedback loop, then that becomes the hamster wheel from hell. We're just stuck on that. And we're limiting all kinds of options in our personal and professional lives. Start talking ourselves into things that we deserve or don't deserve. It just gets worse and worse.
Yeah. And where this ties into leadership too, is that if you're the leader in charge of people, is that all the people under you reporting to you, they have inner voices too. So if someone is not having a good day or the performance is slipping, that they're usually, you know, stellar performers, this is something to consider. What has happened? What are the voices in their head saying to them? You know, have that conversation. Is everything okay? But just, hey, you know, when that happened, how did that feel? You know, what do you say to yourself? And kind of get a feel for what is going on, you know, behind the scenes of that performance. And maybe you can get them some help to improve that and get them back on track. That and that's a whole nother conversation, Michael, but that gets at leadership, having that high emotional intelligence.
Yes. And to that end, I will say it this way. Anytime somebody says to me, how do I get person X to do activity Y? You know, whatever it is, how I get them to work harder, work faster, do better, understand, whatever. The question I come back with is, what do they need to feel in order to do it? Because all too often we find people that they get stuck, they get frustrated trying to understand why their rational solutions don't solve emotional problems. So right. If I want someone to really do something, okay, what do they need to feel in order to execute? Is it confident? Is it supported? Is it educated? Is it, you know, whatever, whatever. Okay, cool. How do I create that feeling? Because if I can create that feeling, I'll get the action.
Yeah. And this goes to, and it's very easy to do at times if you're really thinking. For example, if I have a project, I could say, hey, Michael, get this done, bro. Just get it done. Get out. And you're going to wander off. Okay. But if I bring you, hey, Michael, I need to trust you with this. Okay. That this is really important, because what if this goes wrong, the cascades are bad, and you're my go-to guy. I'm going to trust you with this. See the difference in the verb choice, do versus trust? It sets a different mindset for the employee who's now got this task to do.
Words make a huge, I mean, especially teaching, listening, and communication. I can't go a week without somebody saying, I know, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. We've all been told that. Yeah. But break that down for me. Like, it's not what you say, it's how you say it, but how do we say it? The word choice makes a difference. The tone, the speed of delivery, the distance. I mean, all of these things make a huge difference. And you're right. Words create emotional reactions. And those emotional reactions can be intentional or unintentional. And the more intentional we are about the emotional reactions our words create, the more successful we will be. And that's a shining example.
Yeah. And it's also the physical, because human beings, your whole body is a giant sensor, right? So if I have a task for you and I stand opposite in front of you, it feels a bit confrontational. But if I walk up to you on the factory floor and I come along beside you with the paper and go, hey, Michael, look at this. I can't quite figure this out. What do you think we should do? Can I trust you with this? for standing shoulder to shoulder, side by side, that's more collaborative body positioning.
Yes.
And my tone and my voice, I'm talking to you, working on this together. It's a peer thing, right? That peer influence is huge. See how much easier that is to probably get the behavior and the action and the mission accomplishment that you want. The simple things like that.
And they make such a huge difference. And the person you're talking to subconsciously might realize it. Consciously, they might not say, well, I feel really better with John because he stands next to me. He's not face to face with me, nose to nose with me all the time. They don't have to realize it. They just have to feel it. And then they have to take the actions because of how that feeling makes them respond. It's has a huge impact on them.
Yeah. And it's also that camaraderie, that collaborative environment that I hate to say, call it shared misery, but that's the stress and the difficult things are really where teams start bonding and start helping and producing each other. I know we don't want to have a lot of war stories, but I was on a parachute jump in the Pacific. In the Caribbean island decades ago. So we actually jumped out over the island, left the airplane, and the wind stopped, and the wind was no longer blowing us effectively onto the island, but actually was going to dump us in the water, which is a bad thing when you got a 100-pound rock that you're carrying. So yeah, so we actually managed to make it onto dry land. Got to the ground, secured the parachutes, and actually spend, now a week basically covering ourselves in mud to keep the mosquitoes off, bad food, bad environment, rain, just, typical military infantry type training. But I realized the worse it got, the more the team bonded, the more the platoon bonded, and leaders should take advantage of that natural human capacity to want to bond under difficult situations. This is why that training is, don't shy away from the hard training and the hard task if you're developing a team.
It's not my story to tell, but a friend of mine played college baseball and talked about how minor league baseball, never made it to the major leagues, but played professional baseball. Talked about how, so I guess that does mean he did play college baseball, but that's not where the story comes from, that the bus rides were so miserable that guys from completely different backgrounds, different parts of the country, sometimes different parts of the world, different perspectives, music, whole nine, but they became super close long past their playing days because of the misery they shared on the bus ride. So I didn't play professional baseball. I never served in the military, but the point of the shared sacrifices leading to stronger bonds is 100% spot on.
And leaders should take advantage of that. That natural human tendency to bond together under difficult, hard circumstances. It builds the culture, which is what you're after.
And to your point from earlier, you can set the conditions for that. Yes. When there are hard decisions to be made, when there's extra hours to be put in, when somebody has to take the job that nobody else wants, to steal a phrase from my friend who was in the Army for many years, when the time comes to embrace the suck, are you going to be the one there doing it with them, or are you going to thank them for doing it as you turn the keys over to your Tesla? I guess that'd be pushing a button, not turning the keys over, and leaving to your nice house for the weekend, as opposed to staying and helping them.
Yeah. Embrace the suck is actually in boss in the infantry bar at Fort Benning, Georgia, behind the bar, embrace the suck, because you get it, right? Embrace that rain, the cold, everything else, hold it close and go, I got you.
Make the most of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would love to continue this conversation and dive deeper, and hopefully we'll have another chance to take this conversation in many different directions. I want to be respectful of your day as well. I know you wear many hats and you have lots of things going on. I took 2 full pages of notes while you were talking. So thank you so much for all of the insights that you shared with us today. I have no doubt that people are listening to this and they're thinking, I want to engage with John. Either I am a middle manager, I know somebody's a middle manager, my organization can benefit from John. So for the people who are looking to connect with you, where should they go to learn more about you, learn more from you, and connect with you?
So I have a website, mentallyagilecoaching.com. You can also reach out to me at jpholland, H-O-L-L-A-N-D, 7@protonmail.com.
I'll make sure to share all of those links in the show notes with people as well. I can't thank you enough. Thank you for all of you, all you've done through your many roles in your service. Thank you so much for what you're doing now for leaders as they emerge and grow and develop within their organization. I think it's fantastic that somebody with your level of experience, especially leadership experience, is really focusing on that middle manager. I feel like a lot of times people who have been at the top tend to focus on assisting those who are also at the top. So for you to take that, I know you assist people at the top as well, but for your passion for really bringing it down to those who are still growing in their career, that's not something they get in a lot of places. And I really, really appreciate you giving that to them. Thank you.
Yes, no problem. They're an underserved group that will be in charge one day of the nation's industry and the nation's leaders. And we need to invest in making them the best version of themselves as possible, so they're ready to take the reins of industry eventually.
Well, I certainly appreciate it. Thank you. And thank you for the time and the insights you share with us today. I'm serious. Two pages of notes. I can't wait to go back through them and get them all organized in a file so I can go back and reference them. Take care. Stay safe. And you know, to people that don't know, we're not far from each other. So hopefully we can continue this conversation in person one day very soon.
Michael, my pleasure. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
John, thank you so much for an amazing conversation. How you managed to pack that many insights from multiple aspects of your career into one conversation for leaders to learn from was amazing. Thank you so very much. I could honestly recap the entire conversation, and I hope everybody listening took as many notes as I did. That concept of responding how you rehearse. I think we've all heard some variation of you play like you practice, but that was a great way to bring it up. I also love how you illustrated that leaders must make decisions under pressure and wear ambiguity like a fine, tailored suit. If we had all the answers, they wouldn't need us. So I like that answer a lot. Your conversation about tolerating failure and not just learning from our mistakes, but other people's mistakes as well was quite poignant. And the way that you illustrated your values and how you lead to your values and how you help other people find their values was all very important. And if we have another conversation, maybe we'll wrap the whole thing around mastering our inner voice, because we touched on that towards the end, but that's such a powerful, powerful piece as well. Literally learning to tame and manage and use our inner voice to lead us in the direction that we need to go. Thank you so much for sharing your time amongst a very busy schedule to share so many great points with us today. And of course, thank you to all of you who took the time to listen to the conversation today. I appreciate you being here week after week to learn from amazing people like John and so many other awesome people who have volunteered their time to come on the show so far. We want to thank our sponsors before we go. As always, we have HumanTel. Please, I've done it. Head over to HumanTel.com and pick out which online self-paced training course works best for you to begin to determine what people are thinking and feeling in real time by identifying their shifting emotions through their facial expressions and nonverbal behavior. Enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off the course of your choosing. I highly recommend it. I've done them all. Head over to HumanTel.com. For the professional interviewers, head over to CertifiedInterviewer.com. That's where you can learn everything you need to know about the International Association of Interviewers. All of the benefits, network opportunities, educational opportunities, and resources for professional interviewers. That's also where you'll learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? How do you earn the designation? How do you maintain the designation? And what could it mean for your career? All that and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And please, while you're online, head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the customized programs our clients ask us to facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams in order to teach them how to use the truth to their advantage and encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences across the entire scope of their business conversations. So much more detail over at inquasive.com. I can't thank you all for being here again and again. We really appreciate it. Please, before you go, take the time to subscribe to the show, like the show, share the show, let your friends know about it. Leave us your feedback. What would you like to hear or see more or less of? We'd love to help you with the information that you're looking for. Thank you again. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time.